The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I want possession of real things. I want real things with cash flow. I want cash flow. I want more real things. Whether this is gold or toll bridges or RV parks or infrastructure or, again, gold coins or silver bars or a bunch of cash, hopefully with a little bit of cash flow. Frankly, of all the things that are listed there, yes, we think it's an excellent time to swim upstream.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You know, I was looking at the markets, Dave, and I was thinking, gosh, 30 days ago, gold was below 1300, and now we're up in the 1400s. And, you know, we've waited for this, and we've had controlled markets that have just sort of put us to sleep. And then all of a sudden, kapow, something's happening where you have flight capital going in there. And I was thinking, in a way, we were made for this, and you had told me a story about your girl, okay, your daughter. You guys went mountain biking this weekend, and you said she just continued to say over and over, I was made for this. I was made for this.
Yeah, she's 8 years old, and she's out in the trail in front of me, and I'm just hearing this conversation. Of course, she's a verbal processor like more than a few McIlvaneys are, and I don't know if she's talking to me or the trees or whoever, but I was made for this.
Yeah.
And gold gets to 1365, and it gets to 1365 again, and it gets to 1365 again.
I was getting sick of watching it get beat down every time it got to 1365 the last few years.
Well, and you know that above that point, if you break the glass ceiling, so to say, there's room to move on the upside.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it reestablishes something of a floor, a higher floor, and we may see some consolidation in the coming months, but that's okay. We have decisively broken out of what is really a 7-year consolidation. If you look at what happened between 252 and 1920, those two price points, it was a massive move in gold, and it's taken 7 years to consolidate it.
Right.
It's gradually been getting its feet from the 1050 level back in December of 2015, and again, it keeps on tempting fates here, just below 1400, 1365, 1365, 1365. And so, yeah, you're right. It is almost a surprise. Oh, it happened. And you're right. I think we are made for it.
You know, and I was thinking back to the first Persian Gulf War, because we were seeing gold move, but not silver move during that period of time. And, you know, one of the questions that I've had here recently is, what's causing this rapid move? Is it a fear of inflation or is it geopolitical? I know in the past, gold has moved and silver, platinum, and palladium have sort of ignored geopolitical events initially. And I'm just wondering if somebody knows something that maybe we Americans don't know.
And whether it's geopolitical, political, trade related, I'm not sure that it even matters at this point. We'll figure out why investors were moving more or less after the fact. But what we do have is this bifurcation between gold and silver, where the safe haven purchases of treasuries and of German bonds and of gold coins, or gold bars for that matter, that's on display. What's lacking is silver as a monetary metal with concern for inflation, or platinum with a concern for inflation or what have you. There are periods of time where all real assets do very well, but at least at this phase, we have safe haven buying. That is the determining factor in terms of the flows, both into treasuries, bonds, and gold. So the safe haven buying is the defining factor here, probably not much more than that.
Well, and I think about how central bankers have smoothed over any kind of fear in the past. I remember Mario Draghi back in 2011, August of 2011, he said, we'll do whatever it takes. Well, little did anyone know what that meant was they would just buy everything. And, you know, I'm thinking China here recently, they're making liquidity very, very available. Are they trying to mask possibly a slowdown?
It's amazing when you think back to that August 2011 period and you're looking into the precipice and the potential demise of the Eurozone. By the way, that potential demise and looking into the precipice still exists. But, you know, what we did buy was a certain amount of time. Draghi is running out of time himself. He retires later this year. And we don't know if Weidmann or whoever replaces him will have the same resolve to do whatever it takes. But imagine this. Go back to August 2011. 2011, and the words are spoken again. You hear them in your head. We will do whatever it takes. And all of a sudden, those words transform Cypriot bonds, junk bonds in Greece and in Italy and Portugal and Spain into the best performing assets of the next 3 to 4 years, where you say to yourself, now, how is this possible?
The things that were going to go bankrupt are now the best investments you can possibly buy. Why? Because Draghi's buying them with 2 or 3 generations of future money. He doesn't have the money. Well, let's face it.
You say China. You mentioned China.
Yeah.
The PBOC, that their central bank, is making sure that there's ample liquidity flowing right now. Last week, there was over $40 billion injected into the banking system to bring calm to what otherwise could have been significant sort of bank-run dynamics. But the markets themselves in China are discriminating between the large banks and the non-bank financial institutions. You have the overnight repo rate, which dropped to as low as 1% for the big banks. And that is as a result of the central bank intervention. But your non-bank financials, they remain at a much higher 8% for overnight borrowing. And so what you're seeing is that liquidity is not flowing equally. And as Doug Noland pointed out in one of our recent portfolio manager meetings, that is precisely a late in the cycle dynamic.
And the Chinese must be expecting a too big to fail kind of move, where you only have to pay them 1% for that repo rate for the large stuff. But the non-bank financials, you said 8%. 8% is a high rate in this environment.
Right. So the difference is between the repo market and the pledge repo market. And the pledge repo market is sending a strong signal. And that signal, and this is again in contrast to the repo market, not everyone is getting the easy money from the PBOC. PBOC is creating it. And as we've said many times before, you've got central banks that create liquidity, but the markets direct the flow. So you create the liquidity, markets direct the flow, and this is how the unseen hand of the market works, whether it's self-interest, self-preservation. That unseen hand determines who gets what.
Isn't it strange? Okay, we've got a country that still is communist, that's looking more like a free market country, you know, where we're actually seeing dynamics. An 8% interest rate shows free market dynamics. Yet here in our economy, which is supposed to be free, we're almost more command and control.
And of course, Xi Jinping has tightened controls. We know that he's eliminated, he's given himself kind of a lifetime rule since Mao. There's no one in China who's had more concentrated power than him.
He controls the vertical, he controls the horizontal, he controls the, he actually controls the central bank.
Yeah, well, so there's irony, you're right, that you have some, not all, but some free market dynamics on display in China. And then you cross whichever direction you want to go, cross the pond. You've got Western Europe and the US. They're still increasing the dynamics of command and control. You've got the top-down central planning style, those operations through targeted inflation rates and what the European Central Bank has called OMT. Outright monetary transactions, the purchasing of a variety of assets using the size and force of the central bank balance sheet. I guess the question today is, what is capitalism and where is capitalism truly on display? And I guess I'm not thinking of the crony capitalism or whatnot, but really, as we described it and have in earlier shows, the free markets on display.
Well, and we've talked about the distortion of what we call market discovery, okay? And that's just sort of a fancy way of saying nothing is priced correctly. You'd have to point a finger at the central banking community over the last, especially 7 years, for completely destroying real pricing.
Add math to a study of economics, and instead of just appreciating historically what has been done and good, better, and best business ideas, you conflate who you are and what you do as an economist and consider yourself to be an engineer of sorts, right? Mm-hmm. So this is how economics and PhDs in economics have gone to the heart of central planning. The thesis is that you can engineer economic outcomes, and again, central bankers are right in the heat of this in the community. The Fed, the ECB, the BOJ, the PBOC, they're all kind of got a finger in the pie. They've overstepped their traditional roles. And if you go back, this goes, you know, straight to the global financial crisis. And what they were doing is implementing at the time what was considered extraordinary measures.
They even used those two words, extraordinary measures. That was a quotation by the central bankers saying, listen, we're not going to do this all the time. This is because we're in an emergency.
But those emergency measures, those extraordinary measures have now been normalized.
Right.
And permanent tools, that's what they're considered, permanent tools in their toolbox. So this is a classic power ratchet. You've got crisis dynamics called for a more muscular approach and a more invasive policy stance. As the crisis recedes, the invasive policies remain, right? So you've got both governmental power and central bank influence that share that in common. The market dynamics at present, I think, are very fascinating. And what they share in common, again, is this idea that you ratchet this massive power forward, and then as the emergency recedes, as the crisis recedes, the power structures stay. That's the growth of governments, the growth of central banking in the marketplace. It's an unhealthy thing. It's unnatural, but this is how power ratchets into places that it doesn't belong.
And they have trained investors to love bad news. It's amazing. They love to hear that maybe there's a slowdown, maybe in employment or in growth or what have you, because they know they're going to be fed candy from the Fed or candy from the European Central Bank, what have you. They don't even want to hear good news about the economy because it doesn't give them enough of a spike.
Yeah, it is a sick mindset. It's a disturbed mindset. Whatever justifies the presence of ongoing and increased liquidity is somehow good. So we've transformed the negative, the bad, into the good because that's the justification. That's what allows the central bankers to keep their presence in the marketplace. No longer extraordinary measures, but common and expected.
It's Pavlovian.
It is. So Exhibit A, if you're thinking of kind of the market dynamics today, I think they're challenging. I think they're fascinating. I think they're deadly in the sense that you've got a lot of global investors who are unaware that this is not normal and it's not sustainable and it's entirely dependent on the largesse of the central bank community. So Exhibit A, you've got the naive investor. And what are they doing today? They're relishing the new highs in the stock market. Good for them. But they're doing that without asking the question, where do we go from here? For investors in the current context, again, you sink into the present moment. And this is kind of the mug's game because you're losing what is most important in the investment process, which is anticipation. A long gaze into tomorrow, whether it's next month or next year, you neglect that for the present pleasure that you're experiencing. It's what happens next that has to be processed, not what just happened. Again, investing by looking in the rear view mirror is just a bad idea.
Well, and let's face it, we're all looking practically at how we're getting ahead. I mean, I even look at Trump. Trump was very, very critical during the Obama administration of a loose Federal Reserve policy. At this point, Trump knows that he has to have it himself.
Well, and I think this is at the heart of why we have kind of a continual critique of central banking on our program, because there really isn't a ton of independence, quote unquote, political independence between the Fed and government. And frankly, we've moved away from rules-based administration of monetary policy to ad hoc. And I think that's dangerous too. But you're right. Trump, in this market environment, he'd like to make it even better. He believes that the stock market could be 2, 3, 4, 5, 10,000 points higher. And what does he need to quote unquote trump the current market environment? He needs lower rates. He needs a more accommodative Fed. And that is what the commander in chief is currently whining about. You know, just in this last week, he says, you know, Powell's like a little boy. He's spoiled. He's not doing what he's asked to do. Well, we need more asset purchases. We need another round of QE if we're going to keep this current buzz from fading. And that's why the president's asking for what he's asking for.
Mm-hmm.
We need external stimuli, the kind typically reserved for crisis dynamics. But today, it's being framed differently. An ounce of prevention, and the Oval Office has, frankly, too much at stake to wait for the pound of cure. They can't let the markets roll over at all. They can't let the business cycle flow and then ebb. There is no ebb. No, absolutely not.
He was a critic of keeping Fed rates low in another administration. Now, I'm not trying to be political here. All I know is that when you're president, you want to have easy money.
Yeah, and you could say, well, this is a living contradiction and whatever else. No, he's no dummy. He knows what it takes to keep this empire of debt in motion without cracking apart on his watch. And he wanted the presidency before he was in office, and he reasonably critiqued that this system was held together for the benefit of Obama with accommodative interest rates. But now it's his system, and he still wants it held together, and he knows what it takes. So accommodation from the Fed, money printing, lower rates, asset purchases, he wants to gift, if you want to think of the common man investor, the lumpen investoriate, he wants to gift them with fresh all-time highs in the stock market as evidence that he, Mr. Trump, has delivered something excellent, like a Trump Tower upgrade for all.
You know how he could have done it, and I don't see it happening, but how he could have done it if he would have come into office in 1980, like Reagan did. Okay, because in 1980, we had interest rates that were close to 20%, maybe even higher. And Reagan rode this roller coaster down ride of interest rates from over 20% to what they fall to. I mean, during his administration, interest rates just plummeted from the Carter years. And of course, that's perfect if you're a president, because people can borrow for less and less and less expense on the interest side of things. And it created a huge boom.
Exactly. At least halfway through his first term, Reagan started to see that gift, you know, in an obvious fashion. And you're right. The Fed was dropping rates from the 20% level down to 8% and then 6%. And this is after Volcker, you know, dosed out strong medicine to tame the runaway inflation of the 70s. And for Reagan, this is what made a $1 trillion increase in debt affordable. As his administration doubled the national debt from $1 to $2 trillion, it was no big deal because the interest component was shrinking so rapidly. Probably could have done even more than that. And what he was focused on was outspending the Russians in an attempt to take the lead and gain an advantage in the Cold War. Guess what? He did it. So Reagan was successful in beating the Russians by being a fiscal profligate.
Could you imagine, though? Okay, let's give Trump, let's just assume interest rates are at 20% right now. And we're talking about, what does the future look like? Well, gosh, you can lower rates dramatically, but Trump is actually starting with interest rates closer to about 2%.
That's right. So you don't have the same generosity. You don't have it's not as juicy, the kind of easing cycle that you could have if interest rates began to decline again. I mean, we can take the 10-year treasury from the 2%, that is, and then follow the Germans and other European counterparts in a negative territory with rates below zero. You know, right now, we're at about $11.6 trillion and counting.
Isn't that amazing?
That's debt that yields less than zero. It's a dollar value of debt with a negative yield.
Before 2015, never in history had there been negative rates.
Right.
And you said 11.6 trillion.
But if we took our rates negative, even then we have to wonder if the results are positive. Yes, it perpetuates a business cycle to a degree, but it also completely mutes the signaling typically present in the bond market. The other thing it does, and I think this is important to keep in mind, moving rates lower is a way of stealing from the savers of a society.
It's the retired, especially, that really suffer.
Yeah, so it is just a different form of wealth redistribution, and it takes from the savers and gives to those who are so far in debt that they need some sort of crutch or help with their massive quantities.
Well, they have to speculate in the market to actually make their bills, which that can't last. But you were talking about signaling. Signaling is another name for this price discovery that we talked about.
Yeah, signaling, and this is interest rates, the role that they play, it's what creates restraint in lending. And this is completely muted in the bond market today, but it creates restraint for corporations. And it's restraint for government fiscal commitments. And I mean, if you wanted to look at the road, I'm not trying to be overly dramatic here, but the road to monetary hell, it's marked with signs that say very clearly where you are, and it tells you very clearly your direction of travel, right? That's what interest rates do. It tells you when there's stress in the system.
But if central banks are coming in and buying all the bonds and lowering the interest rates, at that point, it totally destroys that signal you're talking about.
You're controlling the price of bonds, you're lowering the interest rate, you're eliminating that signal, and it's like the signposts being eliminated. You don't know where you're at on the road to hell.
Bridge out.
It doesn't, your direction is still your direction. And the monetary disaster that awaits you is still the same, but the harbinger is gone. You lose the signage, which in earlier business cycle episodes would caution you, might even compel you to turn away, go back before your currency is destroyed, before your business is destroyed. Right?
Well, you remember when you had Steve Hanke on, okay, just a few weeks ago. He talked about those commitments that governments have that are ongoing commitments. That's why they have to print money. That's why they ultimately destroy their currency if they can't meet those commitments.
And I think one of his points would be that it's when you lose your normal sources of funding, when that dries up and you maintain those fiscal obligations, and then all of a sudden you've got the monetary and the fiscal meeting in the middle, where money and credit creation out of nothing is directed towards government spending. And again, you can't finance it the ways you used to, then the inflation rates go crazy. And yes, that's what modern monetary theory is in a nutshell. You need the signals to know where you're at on that path towards that destruction. And within the financial system, you can pretend like all is well, but without the signals, you have no idea how close you are to the edge.
What you're basically saying, Dave, is money is free, and at negative interest rates, money's freer.
Well, yeah. Dick Sill is going to join us later this year to discuss interest rates. And there's an important observation that he's made, is that the current central banks, the way they've constructed this, they're doing things that haven't been done in the 4,000 to 5,000 years of interest rate history, which you described going back to 2014, 2015, didn't exist, just didn't exist. So what do you do? I mean, and again, Dick wrote the book on interest rates. Literally, he wrote the history of interest rates. It's a tome that any financial library should have. But when the signals are muted, the speculators know no limits. And the Main Street investor then moves into this perfect place of oblivion, again, moving forward with a sense of confidence and what we would argue is overconfidence, because they don't appreciate the kinds of risks that are endemic in that environment. But those risks, you don't have the risk signals around you.
Do you remember the old days when we would say, wonder where the bond vigilantes have gone or where they are? Because if they ever came out of the woodwork, which sometimes they did, they spanked everything that was mispriced.
Exactly. The bond vigilantes were the discipline factor, if you will. And so classically, it was the bond investor that we called them a vigilante. And it's like this. When the adults stopped behaving with discretion and honor, and when the adults started to become just straight stock promoters and financial pimps, then the bond market would discipline them with higher rates. And then that's when they would be called vigilantes, because they'd be working sort of on their own to create this sense of discipline. And those higher rates would rein in excess liquidity and credit in the system before you had a real nasty bubble dynamic take hold, then become self-reinforcing and become something that just couldn't be controlled. But it remains to be seen. This is really what's unique in this period of time. If you contrast the way that the bond market used to create a discipline within the financial system, and now you've got central banks of the world cornering the bond market, it remains to be seen whether the bond vigilantes can match the determination of the central bankers to push rates to zero and to keep them there.
I'm reading a pretty good book right now by Nassim Taleb. He's written several books, Black Swan and Fooled by Randomness. But this one's called Anti-Fragile. And he talks about how systems can become fragile when they're given gifts. And think about these low interest rates, Dave. As a business that has to borrow, let's say businesses out there that have to borrow, or governments having to borrow, what have you, if they don't have to run efficiently and can be given loans virtually for free, it creates a fragility that later then has to be fed with more free money.
That's exactly what Jim Grant said in a recent missive. He says this of the low rates. In other words, low interest rates, which foster leverage and speculation, require still lower rates to protect the fragile corporate structures that those very rates made fragile. That's the end of the quote, but there's a sense of sort of policy determinism here. You get into this vortex you can't get out. We can't get out of the cycle of lower and lower rates as we've piled on more and more debt. And frankly, the rate function, it's that factor, if you will, it's the only factor that can be controlled to make the math work. Without low rates, we already know we have too much debt. But with lower rates, we can and have continued to pile on more debt. And what that allows us to do is keep the wealth illusion going a little bit longer. Everyone feels good, everything looks good, everything is fine, but you've got this one factor that has to be controlled. In this case, he wants to control interest rates, Trump does, at least through the next election cycle.
Okay, but for the person who's listening and saying, all right, you guys make perfect sense on all of this, but this has lasted longer than any of us really thought. Could low rates be a permanent factor in our economy?
Well, I think this is one of the things from an investment thesis standpoint. We had assumed that we would see rates return to a normal type of a cyclical behavior. And maybe they ultimately will. Maybe they ultimately will. But the battle is on. The battle royale is there with the central banks going up against the bond vigilantes. And the one thing I would say is that the central banks have the printing presses in support of their cause.
Mm-hmm.
But if they print $1, 1 euro, 1 yen, 1 RMB too many, then they flip an emotional switch in the marketplace and they instantly lose.
The currency is no longer trusted.
That's exactly right.
Right.
So they have the power to buy everything under the sun, and yet they have the power to destroy the value of everything under the sun because of the power they possess. So it's a weird irony. You'd say, no, don't bet against the central banks. Yeah, but if they abuse their power and print one currency unit too many, they've played with psychology and they cannot recover from that. You cannot control the mind of the crowd in that way.
Look at the arrogance in how they've been proceeding.
Well, and I think, you know, somebody like John Williams, John C. Williams, who is the New York Fed president. There's another John Williams who does some good work on monetary policy and
statistics. But this guy's the New York Fed.
He's the New York Fed president, yeah. Also a bright guy. He was speaking to the Council on Foreign Relations recently. And so, again, just think about the audience here. Council on Foreign Relations is listening to the New York Fed president say, and I quote, low interest rates are real, and they are here to stay.
Well, there's the permanence.
There you have it.
Yeah.
If this backdrop creates a greater likelihood of monetary accidents, that's what Grant would suggest it does, then it really should come as no surprise that in other parts of the world, you start hearing about an opt-out. You've got the Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad urging his fellow heads of state in Asia to develop a common trading currency based on gold.
Well, and he can't be the only one. China's been buying thousands and thousands of tons of gold.
When you listen to the plea that Mahathir Mohamad, again, Prime Minister of Malaysia, when he says what he says to this group of people meeting, it was the Nikkei group meeting in Japan just not long ago, he sounds like De Gaulle. So 50 years later, he sounds like De Gaulle, only not from France, but from Asia. Mm. And even though the bond market vigilantes seem to have exited the stage, gold has not. And I think that's one of the things we're seeing in the price action of gold. Gold is expressing a view as it rides a wave of safe haven purchasing. The central planners are playing with fire. That's what gold is signaling. They're playing near the limits of what is tolerable, says the gold vigilantes.
Well, boy, what an amazing point you make. Okay, gold vigilantes. We talk about bond vigilantes, which is really the interest rate cycle. It's interest rates going up when there's danger. But actually, older than the bond vigilantes, which that goes back thousands of years, older than that is the gold vigilante. And really, it's not the person or the people who can control that. Gold somehow has a mind of its own, and it does. It stomps on anyone who has hubris.
It tends to bring a discipline that is unrelished and as quickly as possible disregarded by central bankers because it's the opposite of ad hoc. It is a rule unto itself.
Yeah, but remember what Volcker said in his memoirs. He said the one thing he regretted back from the late 1970s was that he didn't try to control the price of gold.
Yeah, so the action in gold in recent weeks, it's notable. And it's not because of the rapid ascent taking it from 1200s into the 1400s. That's a very short period of time, and it's a decent move. But I think notable is what's moving with it and what's not moving with it, because it's telling you who's buying and why. And there's ample signage here. Again, talking about signaling here for an investor in the absence of a free market and rates and with a cornering of bond prices by central planners, you have to read between some of the lines. So by the way, if gold is acting as the vigilante in this era, guess what you can expect? Exactly what you suggested. You can expect some breathtaking counter-trend moves as the powers that be try to stuff it back into a box.
Oh, you know they'll knock it down. Maxwell's silver hammer, except for in this case, Maxwell's gold hammer.
Well, if the trend is now a long-term trend, and I mean, arguably, clearing 1365, it's a hurdle that from a technical standpoint, it almost feels like Caesar crossing the Rubicon. Mm-hmm. I think what you see is down moves, which can take your breath away. And I think that'll keep a lot of faint of heart investors in the sidelines and keep them second guessing the move. That's great. No problem. As you see the price grind higher over the next several years, what should emerge is a price structure well above what we saw in 2011 and 2012.
So you're thinking it could go above 1900.
Yeah, but those downstrokes in price, that's where, in my opinion, you're going to find the opportunities to purchase and allocate to the metals more advantageously, if you haven't done so to this point in a meaningful way.
Okay. So I was asking myself the question last night because honestly, Dave, I get emotionally angry at the control that the central bankers have exercised, especially since 2011. And I thought, how can I beat these guys? Okay. I mean, they're in their thrones and so I can't dethrone them. But how do I beat them? Well, here's how I beat them. I understand that gold is a limited quantity asset. They like to control unlimited quantity assets. They like to create money out of thin air, control those types of things. But if I buy physical gold every time they knock it down, because they're going to do it, you know that, just like what you said. If I buy some every time they knock it down, there's that much less on the market. Now, I'm not going to make that much of an impact, but people worldwide, especially the Russians, the Turks, the Chinese, it looks like the Malaysians at this point, they're buying and they will ultimately beat the system.
You know, of course, you know that my dad raised me with two versions of the golden rule, do unto others. But the second golden rule was he who owns the gold makes the rules. And I think what is often missed by investors is in this period, 2011 to the present, a lot of physical gold has moved towards non-Western countries. So it's no longer sitting in Zurich. It's no longer sitting in London. It's no longer sitting in New York. It's not a U.S. asset predominantly. What we saw when we had the massive liquidations out of the exchange-traded products, over 800 tons of metal moving from London and New York to Zurich to be melted down and then transferred to, lo and behold, Hong Kong and Shanghai.
Right.
Is a move that we will never see undone. He who owns the gold makes the rules.
So who makes the rules at the end of the day? Is it the Western European central bankers and the American central bankers? Or is it the Asians who now probably control and sit on a big pile of gold, larger than we have?
This is one of the greatest stories in economic and financial and monetary history, and it's being told in our time, the great battle for monetary hegemony. You'd have to go back to when the British were handing over the keys to the kingdom and the U.S. was taking them forcibly, right? Mm. We took the keys to the kingdom from the British. Now, we have that same kind of wrestling match, who is giving or taking, and trade, as we've said in many times in the program before, what you see in the trade spat between Xi Jinping and Trump, it covers over a much larger issue, which is who will lead the world over the next 20, 40, 60, even 100 years. And I think this issue of monetary hegemony is a very big deal. He who owns the gold makes the rules. So let's get back to gold for just a minute, because what is moving in lockstep with gold is absolutely critical. We talked about the buying of bonds, and we also talked about the discussion of central planning and how the central bankers are purchasing massive amounts of bonds and pumping up the price and suppressing the yield. There is also a huge set of investors who expect more pronouncements from the government, from central banks, for asset purchase programs. They expect even lower, even more negative rates in the future, and they're buying bonds as a play, as a speculation on that trend. So it's almost like a speculative front running of central bank pronouncements in the context of what they expect to happen shortly.
Okay, but is somebody looking down the road at this point on the horizon, somebody that we can't name, okay? I think sometimes we try to analyze things to where, well, why did gold do what it did, or why are bonds doing what they're doing? Safe haven assets seem to be the thing right now.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at. You've got multiple audiences doing different things for different reasons, and you have to carve out some of this volume moving into safe havens, moving into gold, moving into treasuries. It's going there because it wants to be in plain vanilla, straight, liquid, safe assets. And someone, I think, is looking to the horizon and doesn't like what they see. And up to this point, it hasn't been the U.S. investor who's looking to the horizon at all.
It's still not.
No, but it's easy for me, if I were in Europe, to say, look, I can get out of German bonds and be sitting in U.S. treasuries and get multiples on multiples of yield just by going to the U.S. treasury market. But I can also go to gold, and it has its own safe haven properties.
Yeah, but let's go back to the Americans. I mean, where are they?
No, they're not in the market. The gold purchases to date have been predominantly in Europe and Asia. That's where it's been robust, but not here. We run a large precious metals brokerage, and I can say that our dollar volumes, along with those of our competitors, is still off 30 to 40% from 2016 levels. Mm. Now, if you're going back to 2016, that was one of the first times we had sort of hit the recovery level of 1365 and then moved sideways to down again. But if you wanted a further comparison, we're down 70 to 80% in terms of volume, dollar volumes, from the 2011-2012 levels. There's really not that many people coming into the market today.
Well, but how about the ETFs? Okay, because I know that's an alternative way people have been buying gold.
In Europe, it's robust. But the last time gold was at these price levels, 1365 and higher, GLD had an extra 200 tons of metal in it. Again, this goes back to the 2016 timeframe. U.S. investors have yet to show up. And I think it's for obvious reasons, because I think on their minds is, why should we worry about tomorrow when today the stock indices are at new highs and we've got a president who is poster boy for some form of capitalism, and he's going to push his weight around and ultimately may get Powell to capitulate. Let's go back to Exhibit A. Again, Exhibit A, you're talking about the investor relishing the present. That's fine. Enjoy it while you can. But remember that the European gold market is telling you something. The Asian gold market is telling you something. Those ETFs are seeing huge inflows by contrast to the U.S. exchange-traded products. The U.S. investor demand for physical gold, it's been low, very low. Year-to-date, you check in with the U.S. Mint, they've sold 75,000 1 ounce gold coins. That's only 22% of the total gold volume sold by this time in 2016.
Hmm.
Well, remember, 2016 was when gold was just starting to show its first signs of life after it declined from 1900 to 1050.
But let's look at who is buying. We talked about Asia. Okay, we talked about China and Russia. They've been selling treasuries and buying gold big time the last couple of years. But the central bankers, Dave, the central bankers, which these are the guys who are controlling the game. Why are they buying? It's what, 74% more gold this year that they bought over this, or 2018, than 2017. So they're buying a lot of gold.
Right. So you break down the consumer into several different areas, and you've got the speculators who are more interested in the futures markets because you've got leverage with a futures contract. You've got an investor who loves the liquidity, the buy and the sell and the trade and the capturing of a short-term gain or a long-term gain, what have you, using the ETF. And then you've got the central banker who it's kind of buying to have and to hold until death do we part. And the foreign central bankers are buying gold today as if Charles de Gaulle was speaking to them in their dreams. Mm-hmm. I mean, we told you this last year, that there was massive accumulation of physical metals by the central bank community as we ended the year in the fourth quarter. That trend is still in play. You've got Q1 purchases, which are up 68% year over year. And this is so interesting from a seasonal perspective, because June is typically one of the weakest demand months for gold, and you typically have lows which are put in for the metal between June and July.
Right.
Right. This is not a typical June.
Well, you know, look at the European central banking community. We've seen this before. A lot of times, June, July, August, they really don't want to have any kind of perturbations in the market because they want to take their six-week holiday, okay? And at this point, we have gold instead very, very active. You were talking about certain bond purchases very, very active. This looks like it could be a long, hot summer.
Yeah, for somebody. I mean, strength in the gold market classically is between August and February, kind of getting kicked off there in August. But something has accelerated the purchases. Mm-hmm. And again, give us weeks or months, we will discover why in the weeks and months ahead. But you may wish to consider that in the absence of bond vigilantes, the gold vigilantes are alive and well.
Let me ask, okay, is it the trade wars? Is it this new Cold War that Napier talked about? Is
Maybe.
It a possible hot war with Iran or somebody that we haven't even looked at yet?
Yeah, perhaps it's trade. Perhaps it's a war that Washington is teeing up at Trump's behest in the event the Fed doesn't do its bidding. You got to have something to save the election and ensure that you're in office for another round. So yeah, Iran is perfectly positioned, and if he needs to, he can swing hard at them. Perhaps it's fragility already on display in the global economy. I mean, let us not forget, we don't have a lot of weakness showing up here in the U.S., but we have a lot of weakness showing up everywhere else on the planet. So how long can that be ignored? And ultimately, are the consequences more grave for pretending that we in the U.S. are on a different track?
I was talking to a client the other day that a lot of his business goes right across the tracks as far as freight shipments goes. And he said, Kevin, you wouldn't believe the drop off in the number of trains that are actually carrying freight right now. That's how he measures his business. And he says, you know, I'm preparing for a recession because there aren't as many people shipping freight this year as there was last year.
Well, that's right, Kevin, and it points to things like the Baltic Dry Index or the Cass Freight Shipments Index, and these are sort of leading indicators for economic activity. You watch the volume, you watch the velocity of real things being moved, and it tells you what you need to know about consumption and the anticipation of consumption, because purchasing managers have to stay ahead of the curve and put things in motion in terms of the manufacturing process and the shipment process to have things on the shelf when the consumer says, hey, I'm ready, I want to spend my cash.
Well, do the statistics show what my client was telling me, that things are slowing down in number?
Yeah, the freight shipment index, the Cass freight shipment index, is down for the fifth month in a row. The last decline was 3%, not a huge percentage decline, but it's consistent drop to lower and lower levels over the last 5 months. And that's international shipping rates. You've got trucking rates, the day rates paid to haul stuff on our interstates. That gets ugly. It's in collapse here in the U.S., down 62.6% in May, year over year. These are earlier signals that sort of run, they run contrary to the latest retail sales figures. You had April and May pretty positive, April revised higher, May not bad. But again, because there is less stuff moving, and ultimately you have to assume that's in anticipation of less demand for stuff, you clue in, at least I do, to folks like the FedEx CFO, Alan Graf, who says, look, global trade slowed in recent months. It's a leading indicator. It points to ongoing deceleration in global trade near term.
And this is FedEx. He was the CFO of FedEx.
Yeah. Steve Tam, he's a research analyst, points out that because trucking participates in all phases of manufacturing, it increases as manufacturing starts to ramp up, giving us a leading indication on economic growth. Well, if it's ramping down, it also gives you an indication of economic decline. And I'm not ignoring the service sector here. Obviously, services are far more important than manufacturing today, but we're looking for clues. We're looking for signals. You have to go find the signals in a world where what would have been your most reliable signal is muted because of artificial traffic. And we're talking about interest rates again.
So let's just go back and look at this last decade and say, all right, we needed to stimulate economy. Whether a person agrees with the central banks did or not, we stayed out of the depression that we would have gone into after the 2008 global financial crisis. So let's say they did the right thing, lowered the interest rates, printed money, stimulated the economy. It's like putting a body on life support in an emergency room. Okay, so you do that. But then they kept it on the emergency life support and they continued. We talked about fragility in the system. Well, Then we stimulated what looked like an economic recovery. It looked like an economic recovery. Now, granted, it was costing us three or four times the money it normally would have, and that money was all debt. But now we've got an actual slowdown occurring. How long can you stimulate things with artificially low interest rates and printed money without paying the piper?
You know, this goes back to the idea of microevolution and how we do see adaptations constantly in light of new inputs. So the weather changes. You know, I just realized a certain sort of microevolution as I got ready for the race at Alcatraz. I started swimming in 45-degree water with a wetsuit, and 58-degree water wasn't so cold at all.
Adaptability, and Dave.
You can get used to just about anything.
Yeah.
What we've gotten used to is a free ride from the central bank community, and we now have adapted. But as you say, this gift, quote unquote gift, has added to greater fragility within the financial system. It has not made us more robust. It has not made us stronger. It has not made us more resilient. In fact, it's done exactly the opposite. So economic pressures at this point, economic pressures of any sort, they're going to point directly to the frailties, the weakness, the inherent fissures in the structure of
the
finance.
The fragility.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's going to make sustainability of what we have today, leveraged entities, leveraged governments, corporations, households, it's going to make the sustainability of those entities questionable.
So give me a time. I know this is completely unfair, but give me a time.
I don't know. I mean, if it's 2019, which is a year of reckoning, or 2020, I guess what is lingering out there is what are the kinds of policy responses which we will see as a reaction to a decline in the stock market or bond market, what have you. Can Draghi or his ilk do whatever it takes, just like they did in August 2011, without there being a significant monetary mashup? Can they avoid moving into sort of a competitive devaluation? I mean, it's just a really interesting environment to be in, because I think we've moved, as my colleague Doug Noland has said, we've migrated the risk from the private sector to the public sector. It's now at the heart of money and credit.
It was at the periphery. He talked about it starting at the periphery, and now it's moving to the very core. And when you run out of core, if it's paper, you better have gold. I mean, you better have something real.
Yeah. So when the problems are at the core, what do they do for an encore? I mean, I know exactly what I want to secure in this environment. I want possession of real things. I want real things with cash flow. I want cash flow. I want more real things. Whether this is gold or toll bridges or RV parks or infrastructure, or again, gold coins or silver bars or a bunch of cash, hopefully with a little bit of cash flow. Frankly, of all the things that are listed there as sort of defensive plays, that really indicates that, yes, we think it's an excellent time to swim upstream.
Well, and you're talking about upstream, but actually it's becoming downstream. We're swimming upstream from the paper guys who think they control everything. But actually, you look at the Asian markets, you look at the central bankers over worldwide, the buying of gold. We're actually getting in sync with them if we're buying real things.
Well, or if we've been buying real things and the rest of the world is just getting on board, it certainly explains price action. Bloomberg's article this last week, very telling, "Melt Up in Safe Havens" was the title. Absolutely fascinating, as you're beginning to see a growing audience of people with similar concerns, because I think they look at the problems on the horizon as challenging, if not unsolvable.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.